Thank you very much indeed, and it's a great pleasure to be here. I do confess that I feel, particularly after that elegant presentation, a little bit awkward in bringing out my my notes, and also I should show you my word processing equipment. I console myself that this is an instance of the clipper ship phenomenon in technology development, a device which was greatly improved long after it became obsolete. I was asked to prepare remarks today specifically about technology. And that forced me to confront the question, what is it that an economist actually knows about technology? And what relationship perhaps does that have to our current economic troubles? And I realized as I thought about this that at one time, economists knew a great deal more about this topic than they generally appear to know today. Adam Smith, after all, begins his inquiry into the wealth of nations with his study of the pin factory, the iconic division of labor, whose extent, he says, is limited by the growth of the market. A very clear relationship between productivity and the globalization of his time. David Ricardo, writing in the time of the Luddites, was perhaps the first political economist to recognize that technological development produced tensions and problems and was not necessarily in the interests of the working people who were most affected by it. Karl Marx developed this insight into an analysis of the tension between what he called the increasing organic composition of capital, the increasing capital intensity of production, and the need for an ever greater expansion of markets in the face of declining purchasing power by working people. This was the essential 19th century analysis of the problem of crisis in the capitalist system. In the 20th century, a conservative, an arch-conservative, Joseph Schumpeter, agreed with Marx with respect to the fundamentally destabilizing possibilities of technological change, while at the same time he agreed with Smith that in fact what had happened and would continue to happen was not a decline but a vast and inexorable rise in living standards and the quality of life as the result of technological progress. Capitalism, he said, did not consist in creating more civic stockings for queens, but rather than in making them available. This is a politically incorrect remark to shop girls at an ever, in return for an ever decreasing amount of effort. Thorstein Veblen, who incidentally, the great American cynical economist, also wrote, following Ricardo, on the problem of sabotage. The sabot, as you recall, was the wooden shoe that the Dutch or the Northern French or Belgian peasant would throw into the machinery to keep it from operating. But Veblen also pointed out how technological change took exotic capacities such as silverware, the silverware and cutlery of aristocrats, and replaced them with stainless steel, which was just as useful and in many ways better, as well as, let's say, replacing the carriage with the automobile to a similar effect. In the second half of the 20th century, the subject in economics divides. between a tradition that largely followed Schumpeter, and was closely associated, I think, with the works of my father, John Kenneth Galbraith, and what we might call a neoclassical tradition with a strong root down the street in Cambridge at MIT. My father's work stressed the role of the great corporation as an organization of technologists. The point of the large company was to integrate science and science-based talent in complex tasks, to permit a division of labor to be organized efficiently inside an organization. The metallurgy, chemistry, physics, and mechanics all required to produce an efficient motor vehicle or airplane, for example. This was the role of what my father called the technostructure in a book published in 1967, The New Industrial State. A body that basically reflected the previous conception that Thorstein Veblen had of the engineer. The neoclassicals, on the other hand, and this is where I think the economists' appreciation of technology reached its peak and began to decline, they abstracted from all of this. In their models, technology falls largely from the sky, a gentle rain from the cloud of science, augmenting now capital, now labor. Their estimates showed that, or showed to economists anyway, who were susceptible to believe these things, that technology could account for 70% of economic growth, far more than the increase of capital considered by itself, or the increase in the size of the labor force. And yet, this central fact in the post-war analysis of economic growth was also removed from being a serious object of study. It was there, everybody said it was the most important thing, nobody had the slightest idea what it was. It was something that we as a profession came to accept, but not to understand. And that brings us to the age of technology, as we now use the term, especially information technology, digital technology, software, pure knowledge reduced to lines of code. It's a problem that I have tried to tackle in the book that you mentioned a few minutes ago. And it's perhaps no surprise that my own father's work serves as the point of departure for this line of analysis. What did these new technologies, information technologies, do to the world that existed 40 or 50 years ago, the business world, the corporate world, the world of great enterprises dominated by largely North American multinational corporations? Obviously, they transformed it. They broke apart the previously tightly integrated corporations with their in-house laboratories, with their Bell Labs and so forth, and they spun them off into new ones that were specialized in information technology. New ones such as the company, the distinguished company that is hosting this gathering, that were therefore able to devote themselves solely to this particular line of business and to earn for themselves the rents, the enormous returns that were available to the technological innovator across a wide range of markets. Indeed, rents that were previously distributed within the company to the whole production process. Much of the latter became very vulnerable. Some of it, much of it, was outsourced, could be outsourced. And there came to be a kind of global divide between the information technicians and all the other
forms of economic activity between the producers and the consumers of this line of work. If you look, for example, at the sources of rising inequality in the United States, something I've done at great length over the last 15 years, you find something very interesting. One way to look at it is to analyze the concentration of incomes in the U.S. across geographic regions, and the most convenient unit of analysis for that is the county, a very small geographic unit. And you discover that if you take five counties out of the mix, half of the rise in income inequality disappears. And what are the five? Well, one of them is Manhattan, New York, New York. And the other four, one of them is King County, Washington, home of Microsoft, and the other three are Santa Clara, San Francisco, and San Mateo counties, California, Silicon Valley. That's where the income occurred, and that's where it was booked. And what we observe in the gross data is a rise of inequality is, in fact, simply the information technology revolution. So let's come now to the hard question, to the difficult issue. Schumpeter spoke of creative destruction as a general phenomenon in the development of technologies. Here we have an epic period of creation and transformation, something which has been discussed already. A previous presenter said that, half of all profits, 80% of all profits, and half of all profits are based on products produced within the last 5 years. Words to that effect in any event. What's the other side of this particular phenomenon? What should we think and do about the balance of these effects? Creative destruction in a technological revolution is very different from, let's say, the consequences of a physical war. In a war, the destruction happens first, and the creation and the reconstruction happens afterwards. In this sequence of events, we have a period of construction, and then in the diffusion, there is a displacement of the previous forms of enterprise. Thus, the boom in automobiles, trucks, and agricultural equipment, tractors, in the 1920s North America preceded and then caused the collapse of a horses and humans-based farming in the 1930s, displacing about one-third of the land, which had previously been used to raise farm animals on, and idling a great many of the workers, driving them all out of the farms and into the cities. Similarly, the discovery of vast reserves of cheap petroleum in the 1930s augured the end of a coal and rail-based economy, which declined in the U.S. over the 40s and 1950s. And what happened with information technology? Something similar, but I think, and would argue, on an even larger scale. First, a vast boom with a substantial degree of investment, indeed, perhaps overinvestment, but with the effect that in the 1990s we all experienced this moment of extraordinary exuberance. Capital was very freely available. People were taking advantage of the whole range of opportunities that appeared to be there, and as a result, the entire world economy moved very close to its production frontier, to full employment. And then an erosion set in all of the competing areas, whether one's talking about office staff, clerical workers, bank tellers, postal workers, accountants, tax preparers, low-end programmers, newspapers and book publishers, video stores, and some of this was already again discussed by my preceding speaker. One can go on and on and on. The more powerful the technology, the more things in the previously existing world that it will place at risk, and only a few of them will survive by adapting and becoming a technologically superior and antique product, like a very good economics professor, for example. This is perhaps the most powerful technological change for this purpose since the invention of the combustion engine, and perhaps even more powerful and far-reaching than that. And so the down phase in the cycle actually began with the crash of the NASDAQ in 2000, and I would argue it has been ongoing over the decades since. From a social standpoint, of course, things have not been nearly as serious as they were in the 1930s so far, because they have been buffered by institutions that did not exist at that time, by the vast capacity of the modern state to absorb the people who are displaced, provide them some comfort and some compensation, retirement under Social Security, unemployment insurance, disability, food assistance, and all the rest, and by the fact that we are vastly wealthier. We have a vast accumulation of private capital resources that we didn't have before, so that we are more comfortable in this state of dislocation than people were 70 or 80 years ago. On the other hand, there's still no telling where we are in the process, how far the displacements will go on, or when, or indeed if they will end. The fact is that what we have in our hands is a very inexpensive way to replace a lot of human labor and the means to outsource and offshore a great deal more. And so, ultimately, the burden of the effect and of the crisis shifts from the direct human cost to the public finances that have been buffering that cost. And that is what we observe in the United States with an enormous preoccupation these days with this question of public deficits and debt. And it's, of course, what we are observing in Europe, where the issue is complicated by the institutional arrangements of the European Union and the fact that there is a very incomplete mechanism for the support of the public sector in the peripheral countries of Europe. And let me add one further issue, one further feature of this, which I think has implications that we should all bear in mind. And that is the effect of the new technologies on the functioning, indeed on the integrity, on the confidence that we have in the financial markets. What happened as a practical matter in the United States, and I wouldn't say that technologies were entirely responsible for this, but they facilitated and fostered the displacement of a banking model based upon loans to businesses, especially to small and medium-sized businesses, as the primary line of work in the credit sector, to a business model based upon loans to households, to individuals, by the millions. Something that could only be managed by machines, by statistical processes, and by quantitative analysis of the associated risk. That is to say, a mass market in mortgage lending and the resulting tranching, securitization, and so forth of the mortgage-backed securities and their sale to the broader investment community, rated, of course, by the ratings agencies according to quantitative risk assessment models, and insured, at least allegedly insured or supposedly assured, in the market for credit default swaps. This is something that could not have happened at scale without the benefit, without the clerical services, if you like, of computers, without statistical risk management, without the digital slicing and dicing of the securities. And it may have produced a grave consequence that caught in the vortex of collapsing confidence, it may be very difficult to escape, very difficult to restore a sense that the institutions involved here are operating on the same basis of trustworthiness and confidence-inspiring capacity that we expected of them in the period before all of this development and history came to pass. It may be that there is no way to escape the feeling that one can never know in the future exactly what your counterparty risk may be. And if that's the case, it may be very difficult to coax investors away from the deep safety of the liquidity and stability assured by investment in the public debt of big countries who pay their interest on the basis of the functioning of computers in their treasury departments back to the wilds of private risk-taking companies, at least anytime soon. So the question I would ask as we think about the phenomenon of creative destruction is whether the credit system has been as well a victim of that technological process. That's a problem for which I do not have an answer, and in the nature of things, there may not be one, and we will not know for some time. The technology firm in this situation, to borrow a line from Mr. Lloyd Blankfein, to whom I trust you will agree with me, it does not apply, is surely doing the Lord's work. Reducing costs, improving competitiveness, creating wealth in the very specific sense of creating the potential for greater real production with less effort. This is something from which there is the potential, obviously, for vast benefit, and that potential is realized to the extent that businesses are able to take up these technologies and put them into place. But whether it will be realized fully, whether the benefits will in fact be seen to be enjoyed in excess of the costs of the disruption, is an open question whose answer depends on how society organizes and mobilizes itself to deal with the people and the technologies that have been displaced. Paying them to be idle, paying them to be unemployed, is a very poor solution. Leaving them unemployed without compensating them is a path to poverty, a poverty which is going to affect us all, whether we are directly in that situation or not. The private credit markets, which we might hope would launch at least some people into entrepreneurship and create the framework for organizing new forms of activity, are not at the moment doing that job, and I just raised a question as to whether they would do so. Allocation by the public sector has been out of fashion for quite a few years, and it's very hard to imagine it coming back into fashion in Greece, in Europe, in the United States, or anywhere else anytime soon. In fact, I don't think it will come back into fashion even in China. So what to do? I think the answer lies in still greater exploits of our imaginations. That is to say, perhaps in using the techniques and talents of the advanced technology company to rethink how we organize ourselves and to develop for ourselves a form of society in which we can, in fact, make use of the displaced people soon and efficiently in a way which is gratifying to them and useful for all of us. And maybe we can build on some of the successful institutions that we still have. I think social insurance institutions are very useful and do not deserve the bad reputation they have. Coming from the United States, I am very, and being effectively a participant in the not